Morning, everyone. My name is Michael Gibbons. I'm joined today by Judges Jerry Tao to my right and Judge Bonnie Bullitt to my left. This is our second oral argument today and our second time that we're back in person since January of 2020. So thank you to all of you or each of you that could be here today to have this case argued in person. We have Marvell Henry versus State of Nevada Employment Security Division and other respondents. This is the time set for oral argument on case 82285-COA. And I understand we have a special guest to maybe that's not the right word, but a special person to argue the case for Mr. Henry, Mr. Ballard. Okay, and you're with your supervising attorney here today, Ms. Hanks. Okay, and Mr. Neidert, is that pronounced correctly?
Absolutely.
It is? All right. Are you in the Las Vegas office?
No, I'm at Portland Park.
Okay. So did Mr. Jordan want to come down here or not come down here?
I agreed to do this. He didn't. We're doing some training for our referees the other day, and obviously that he asked me.
Okay, well, thank you for coming to Las Vegas then for the argument and not asking to have this done remotely, which you could have done. We appreciate the in-person argument. Okay, so Mr. Ballard, if you could step forward and introduce yourself.
Good morning, Chief Judge, judges. My name is Alex Ballard, and along with my supervising attorney, Karen Hanks, we represent the appellant, Marvell Henry, in this matter.
Okay, and what's your status now as a student lawyer?
Well, I'm a third-year law student at the UNLV Boyd School of Law with practicing under my student practice license from the Nevada State Bar.
Okay. Have you ever been to court before?
Not this court. I've been to the 8th Judicial District Court several times.
Oh, okay. Well, you're getting tremendous experience then.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you volunteer to do this case?
I did, yes.
Okay. Well, you're pretty lucky. Not very many students get to appear in district court and in appellate court while they're still law students. So I hope you enjoy this experience. We oftentimes get questions before we do presentations with the bar, like, what would you tell a new lawyer to do or not do? We'll wait till this is over before we give that advice to you.
Sounds good, Your Honor. Thank you.
And you picked the right case because this is the first in-person oral argument we've had since 2020. If you picked another case, you might have had to do this remotely. So this is more, you know, more of a realistic experience for you. So, but we're excited to have you here and glad you're taking such an interest and looking forward to the argument.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Well, we value the pro bono project, as I know everyone does, because it's so beneficial. So thank you for being here. Thank you, Ms. Hanks, for supervising, and we are just delighted to have people in the courtroom and at council table, and we're really looking forward to the argument.
Okay. All right. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. All right, you may proceed.
All right. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Alex Ballard, representing the appellant in this matter, Mr. Marvell Henry. Your Honors, no financial means, no new charge, no conviction. This case today is about whether a man with limited financial means who fell behind on some payments due to brief unemployment and indigency, who was subsequently arrested as a result, should be denied unemployment benefits for disqualifying misconduct under NRS 612.385. Now, today we ask that you reverse the district court's denial of Mr. Henry's petition for judicial review for two reasons. First, the district court erred in its application of the Supreme Court's 2016 decision, State Employment Security Division v. Murphy, in finding that there was misconduct in Mr. Henry's case. Similarly, under Murphy, the district court erred in finding that it was irrelevant that Mr. Henry's family members had dutifully notified his employer of his absence and temporary unavailability. Now, beginning with my first point, so under Murphy, the Supreme Court said that it is disqualifying misconduct if you are absent and incarcerated from your line of work. Now, what's important to remember about this decision and why it's distinguishable from this case is because in that case, Mr. Murphy, who was the claimant in that case, had been arrested for possession of stolen goods during the time in the course of his employment. He was arrested, pled guilty, and had a year in prison before he came out and requested unemployment benefits. Now, in this case, Mr. Henry's charges that he was facing were minor traffic fines that took place in January of 2018. Now, the employment that we're discussing in this case occurred from March to April of 2019, so nearly a year and a half later. Now, what happened was Mr. Henry, unfortunately, due to a failure to notify the court of a change of address, missed notices regarding a hearing with the Las Vegas Justice Court. As a result of that, a bench warrant was issued in April of 2019, and he was picked up and detained awaiting a court hearing. Now, again, I want to emphasize the difference there between that and Murphy. In Murphy, the claimant, pled guilty and was incarcerated as a result of his new criminal charge. In this case, Mr. Henry faced no new criminal charges in April of 2019. Rather, he was merely facing ongoing financial difficulties that were as a result of his charges from a year and a half prior, which again were just minor traffic fines. And at the end of his incarceration, or his brief detainment, I should say, one of those charges were dropped and one had his payment plan reinstated. Now in Murphy, the court noted that this incarceration had to come after a criminal conviction and criminal charges, which is why the point here of the no new criminal charges is particularly important in this case. Really, there's no new criminal misconduct within the meaning of NRS 612.385 connected with his work. Rather, it was merely a ordinary negligence failure pursuant to the Supreme Court's decision in CCSD v. Bunley that Mr. Henry failed to update the Las Vegas Justice Court with his new address and thus missed those. Now, if you look at the record reflects that Mr. Henry had been making payments prior to that. However, in late 2018, he experienced 3 months of homelessness, which rendered him indigent and unable to keep up with those payments. Now, this is important because this brings me to my second point regarding the dutiful notification. Now,
Before you move on to that, let me ask you this question. This is kind of a variation of an argument that was raised below. It wasn't explicitly raised, but what do you think of this argument here? Bench warrants are not just issued for people who are guilty. They're also issued for complying with the court. You know, we issue them all the time. You don't show up. You don't do this. Even if you're ultimately not guilty, you have a responsibility to show up to court in response to a subpoena, for example. So what do you think of the argument that, okay, maybe your underlying criminal court was dismissed, but you did miss some court dates. You triggered a bench warrant. It was your own behavior that did that. You took no steps to clear up the bench warrant, which you can do. You can file a motion across a bench warrant. And this bench warrant's hanging out there like a loaded gun. Anytime you come in contact with the police, you can get picked up and incarcerated because that's what warrants are. So because of that conduct, that you triggered a bench warrant by noncompliance, whether or not you're guilty of the underlying thing, and then didn't clear it up, that you're leaving this bench warrant out and getting picked up is your fault for missing employment. What do you think of that?
Yes, Your Honor. So I can certainly see how it could be interpreted that way. However, under the decision in Bunley, it requires much more to qualify as misconduct under NRS 612.385. It requires substantial disregard and deliberate indifference to the employer's motives. In this case, and as further explained in the Barnum v. Williams decision, this was mere ordinary negligence. Again, you could still fault Mr. Henry for not updating his address and missing that, but the record does reflect that prior to that, he had been complying with his court hearings. He had been making payments prior to his brief period of unemployment and indigency. And beyond that, once he was incarcerated for, again, a period of merely 6 days, he then followed up with the court, was told that he should not have had that bench warrant issued in the first place due to the circumstances with his payment plan. So again, it's a different circumstance in this case that doesn't rise to the level of misconduct necessary for disqualification under NRS 612.385.
Before you move on, Mr. Ballard, there is one other question though, factually. You've talked about the Las Vegas Justice Court and the Las Vegas Municipal Court. What about the Justice Court in Paringat Valley in Lincoln County, since there apparently was a warrant for a speeding ticket there, and he was not released on that until May 3rd. So that may be new rather than old criminal conduct, like you're talking about with the traffic violations in the two Las Vegas courts? How does that factor into it? And I know it's problematic because the appeals referee didn't address it.
Correct. No, Your Honor, you addressed that point exactly right. The appeals referee did fail to take in substantial evidence from Mr. Henry that he tried to introduce them. Now, the record reflects that the appeals referee, in fact, continued the hearing at that time so that Mr. Henry could gather this evidence from a hearing later that day with the municipal court. Now, he went to that court hearing. He did get a lot of those papers and followed up with the appeals referee, but she failed to include that in the record with the evidence. Now, as to your question regarding the speeding ticket, my understanding is that still, even from the course of his employment in March to April 2019, was still prior conduct. And again, this still goes to Murphy's point about indigency. Again, the record reflects that Mr. Murphy was someone who had been experiencing differing levels of low socioeconomic status throughout 2018 and 2019. And here, when the Murphy court held that when due to indigency, you cannot find disqualifying misconduct under NRS 612.385, and I believe that still applies here, as evidenced by the fact he had a payment plan, he had fallen behind in that payment plan, and once he was released on May 3rd of 2019, the payment plan was reinstated. So it shows his ongoing financial difficulties that render this a different case than the one the court was looking at in Murphy.
Mr. Ballard.
So the short answer is that other charge doesn't factor into this?
It does, to the extent that it speaks to the indigency that Mr. Henry experienced. And again, really, if we come down to it, if we're looking at trying to apply Murphy to this case, again, in Murphy, we're looking at a year pled guilty of stolen possession of goods while in the course of his employment. Here, we're dealing with one speeding ticket that was prior conduct, which was just a minor fine. And again, those are very disanalogous facts that it seems very substantially, it would really be a step in the wrong direction to apply the Murphy facts to this case with just one traffic violation.
I'm sorry, Judge Ball, go ahead.
Mr. Ballard, the record below was somewhat confusing in front of the appeals officer. I just want to make sure that you understand that we don't look at what the district court did. We are looking at what the appeals referee, I believe is the correct term, did. So that's part of our focus. But what concerns me is, what warrant was Mr. Henry, what warrant was Mr. Henry arrested under? From what jurisdiction?
So my understanding, it was both of the aforementioned charges, the expired license plate charges, which I believe were from Clark County, and then, as Judge Givens mentioned, the speeding ticket from Lincoln County, both of those, which compounded the length of his detention.
But did, right. There may have been a warrant from Lincoln County, which is why someone, I believe it was in May 2nd, 3rd, posted bail for him. But was he actually arrested under that warrant? And if so, can you point to the record to demonstrate that?
I actually believe that warrant was discovered while he was detained. So initially it was just the expired license plate charge that, as I mentioned previously, was ultimately dismissed a few days later. I think that second bench warrant was discovered a few days later into that detention going into the beginning of May that kept him there a few days longer.
And there was no bench warrant issued by the Las Vegas Municipal Court, correct?
I believe so, yes.
So, keeping all of that in mind, when he was arrested under the bench warrant for the Las Vegas Justice Court initially, and then at some point they probably discovered the other warrant, but when he was arrested, at that point in time, he was actually terminated from his job prior to the Lincoln County issue at least being handled.
That's correct, Your Honor, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. So continuing on to my second point as to the dutiful notification. Now, the court in Murphy characterized dutiful notification as relevant only when either the charges that caused the incarceration were ultimately dropped or dismissed, or indigency caused it. Now, here we have evidence of both of those factors at play. As to the first charge, as previously mentioned, with the the expired license plates, that charge was ultimately dismissed by the Justice Court. And secondly, with the speeding ticket from Lincoln County, there is evidence again of Mr. Henry's ongoing indigency that caused his inability to make bail initially and ultimately return to work in a sooner fashion that may have prevented his termination on that specific charge. Now, here, again, we have evidence of both those things. And it's interesting that the district court specifically cited a California case, Kaler, which had very analogous facts in the sense that the claimant in Kaler had a 7-day traffic fine induced sort of incarceration. And the court found that that was not meritorious to disqualify unemployment benefits in that case. So here again, the district court did cite the case as showing Nevada's overall unemployment scheme and what we look for in regards to indigency and dropping charges that are dismissed, because we recognize that that does not get to the level of misconduct that NRS 612.385 requires.
How do you define misconduct then?
So in this case, I think that the proper interpretation of Murphy in regards to misconduct involves a new criminal misconduct, new charges brought. And I think that makes sense if you look at Murphy and you look at cases that precede Murphy as well. Again, in Murphy, this was new criminal conduct, new charges brought, and the claimant pled guilty in that case. We do not have that here. So how I would fashion the rule and propose that to the court would be when new charges are brought or new criminal charges, conduct, misconduct is created, that would create the issue that invokes what the Murphy court was discussing. But again, we do not have those factors here.
Why does it have to be new? What if he killed the guy 20 years ago and just got away with it until now, and now he's arrested for a 20-year-old crime? Would that be misconduct?
Well, it would be, because again, the charges would have just been brought in the course of, hypothetically, in the course of the employment. Whereas again, here we're talking about charges that were brought nearly a year and a half prior that had been just fined. And then here it was simply a maintenance issue in regards to the payment and a change of address and just a mix up clerically in that regard, in terms of missing the court's notices for hearings.
But the appeals referee did not consider the exceptions to Murphy.
That's correct. The appeals referee pretty strictly applied Murphy to the extent of the written language of incarceration equals disqualification. And I see my time is almost up. May I briefly conclude? So again, here we have a case that's very disanalogous to Murphy. And for that reason, the district court erred in one, viewing this case as misconduct, and two, finding that the dutiful notification requirement was not relevant. And for the foregoing reasons, we ask that this court reverse and remand the district court's denial of the petition for judicial review. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ballard. You did reserve some time for rebuttal. That's one of the mistakes that some new lawyers make, is they end up talking over all the rebuttal time. So you didn't make that mistake.
Perfect. Thank you. If it pleases the court, my name is David Neidert. I'm Deputy Legal Counsel for the Employment Security Division of the Department of Employment Training and Rehabilitation. This case is an incarceration case, and incarceration cases have an exception to the rule, basically not a, let's at least is our view, that have an exception to the rule. That is, if you cannot make bail, if you're incarcerated purely due to indigency, that's not going to be disqualifying for unemployment purposes. However, if you are incarcerated through conduct of your own, no matter what that conduct might be, then you are not eligible for unemployment. And in this case, the appellant engaged in misconduct. And the misconduct he engaged with had everything to do with not complying with a payment plan that was set by the Las Vegas Justice Court. Now, they try to excuse this by saying, well, he had some time of homelessness and this and that. But what he did not do during that time, when he was not following his payment plan, which caused the Justice Court to enter the bench warrant, was make a phone call. He could have stopped that bench warrant from being issued by maintaining contact with the court, by letting them know they had circumstances where he could not pay. And likewise, when he changed his address or became homeless, notifying them that if you send things to my old address, it's not going to arrive.
Well, hang on a second. So if the standard is that if someone is incarcerated purely due to indigency, that's not wrongful conduct. But if the reason he can't comply with his payment plan is purely due to indigency, right? In this case, he didn't show up to court because he's going to get a bench warrant. But if he had not complied with his payment plan, he could have been found in contempt of court and incarcerated for not making the payments. Isn't that basically the same standard?
I don't think so, because I think the difference is that, as I said, he was arrested because the court had taken the step of, and were decided that basically that he was not complying with a payment plan. But as I said, you know, court, I know, in my experience, I've practiced criminal law for a long, long time in my career before I started practicing administrative law with the Employment Security Division, is courts work with people. Courts don't like issuing warrants. Courts that don't like doing what they don't have to do. So the misconduct,
let's play with that hypothetical. Courts typically work with people. Courts don't like doing that, incarcerating people for not paying, right? But they could. It's in the discretion. They wouldn't be reversed if they did it. So if a court did that, if it exercises discretion in the unusual case where someone's not paying because that is a power the court does have, would that be misconduct?
Well, I think until the just change of the law, a traffic violation technically could result in a jail sentence. Moving back from that, I think the court could decide, well, I'm not going to work with somebody. But again, the question becomes, what caused the person not to work with them? The person entered into a payment plan and then they didn't follow that payment plan. Then that's where the misconduct occurred. And I think, there's some language from Murphy that really, I think, articulates the standard because...
Well, Mr. Nyder, hold on a second. Before you go into that legal analysis, factually, weren't the charges in the Las Vegas Justice Court dismissed? So does that change the direction you go with your analysis, or are you just arguing for a broader term, misconduct, and what it might mean?
Well, I would say that misconduct, I was going to read a brief quote from Murphy that sort of, I think, might somewhat answer your question.
Go ahead.
An employee who has been incarcerated because of criminal conduct is being penalized for unlawful and improper behavior, and in committing that behavior, the employee has carelessly disregarded the employer's interest in having an available workforce. Misconduct here is connected with work because an employee's unauthorized absence affects an employer's ability to efficiently operate his business. Again, in this case, Your Honor, this wasn't a situation where he couldn't make bail. This was, again, a situation where he had not complied with the requirement that he follow the payment plan, and he hadn't stayed in contact with
the court. Well, how do we know about the bail situation? The appeals referee didn't appear to inquire into indigency, or at least make any factual determinations.
At a referee hearing, it's certainly on the claimant to present evidence, and there was no evidence presented basically either way with respect to that. I would agree that the referee could have gone into more detail than the referee did in this case.
Mr. Nyder, I want to just backtrack for a moment. So let's say the Las Vegas Justice Court was correct in issuing the warrant. I just want to make sure that I understand correctly. But for the arrest warrant issued by the Las Vegas Justice Court that led to Henry's arrest, there is no evidence in the record, unless you can tell me, that Henry was arrested on any other warrant. Is that correct?
There's nothing else in the record to reflect that.
Okay. And at some point when he's taken into custody, apparently the authorities realize there's another warrant from Lincoln.
Sure, and that happens all the time.
Right.
The company's being booked, they run their record and this person, and it might be more, right, maybe more severe charges in another jurisdiction, could be all kinds of things.
But for the Las Vegas Justice Court warrant, he never would have been arrested.
But I think that would be, I think you have to look, and I agree the record's not in this case, but I'm to answer your hypothetical. I think you have to look at the totality of all the charges with respect to whether or not it's disqualifying.
Well, now, wait a minute. Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department is not going to just arrest someone who doesn't have a reason to be arrested. They're not going to look broadly at someone and say, oh, I bet you did X, Y, and Z as well. I mean, they're not going to do that. They're going to arrest him pursuant to a valid warrant.
Right, because you got a traffic violation walking across the street, and they're going to give him a warning, and then they discover the Las Vegas warrant. So I think Judge Bull is saying, but for that warrant from Las Vegas Justice Court, he would not have been arrested.
And I would agree with my answer, my hypothetical, if I could take that, and I'm talking hypothetically in that situation, let's assume that at the same time he was arrested, and they find that there's another warrant, maybe from another county, and they said, well, we're going to dismiss our charges for jaywalking because Washoe County wants him for commercial burglary. And I'm not, that's not this case. I understand that.
Mr. Henry was never arrested for jaywalking or given a ticket or.
Well, I understand, but I do the jaywalking now, you know, my point is, I think overall you have to look at the totality of what happened with the person to see. I mean, I don't think you can say the charge that they were not convicted of the charge they initially arrested on, so we're going to give them work, we're going to give them unemployment. But I think you have to look at everything that happened to them.
But in this case, of course, the charge was dismissed, the warrant was quashed, and the appeals hearing officer was in fact aware of that by the additional documentation that was brought in by Mr. Henry, right?
I would agree with that, yes.
Okay. But then the appeals officer did not apply the exceptions under Murphy. If a charge is dismissed, they cannot, use that as disqualifying misconduct. I mean, misconduct may happen, but it has to be disqualifying misconduct. All the court said is I need some better proof from the court. I don't know what better proof, appeals referee. I don't know what better proof you could have. I mean, nobody's going to debate that, correct?
But I think sometimes, I mean, I think referees oftentimes are looking for some sort of documentary, something from a court saying, or something like that, as opposed to somebody just saying.
All the lawyers in the room know that's not going to happen, you know. I mean, you're going to see an official document or a docket sheet of dismissal.
I understand that, but our referees typically are not lawyers from right. Clemson County.
Well, she sure didn't. This referee did not consider the exceptions of Murphy.
And the references were all in the plural, but to Las Vegas Justice Court or Municipal Court, there was nothing said about Lincoln County. Is that correct?
That's correct. Lincoln County was, we don't know what happened with Lincoln County.
So right. That wasn't the reason then that he was denied his appeal because of the Lincoln County case.
Not the way the referee wrote the decision, certainly no.
Just one side question. Mr. Jordan prepared the order for the district court on the petition for judicial review, and it's a tremendously more detailed than what the appeals referee's order is. Was there some supplemental record, or I mean, how did this come about that you have something, if you know, the much more detailed order?
I'm not sure. I mean, certainly Mr. Jordan in preparing the order would have the entire record and not just the referee's hearing and the referee's determination and looking at, you know, what was available in the record in wrapping its response. So, I mean, everybody, including this court, it's the record that was it's the entire record. Not, in fact, I think the Supreme Court case law, this is not even the record before the district court. The entire record of that person is whether.
So should we do what Judge Bullis said at the outset? We're just essentially going to ignore the district court order because our duty is to review what the appeals referee did?
I think the district court in administrative law cases is sitting as an appellate court, and the review of the district court's order in this kind of case is de novo. So however the court wants to view de novo, whether it wants to ignore it or consider it or whatever, it's de novo review.
Ignores is a strong word. He never ignored it. I mean, we obviously read it. So the question is, how do we apply it? And I thought if the record had been supplemented in some way, then maybe we'd look at it differently because there seems to be much more of a factual discussion, or is it just the nature of these hearings in front of appeals referees that they're very summary?
I think the appeal referees hearings are rather summary. And like I said, so I think Mr. Jordan would have based his order on what was certainly presented in the referee hearing and in the record from the Employment Security Division that he had in front of him. But that would be the entire record.
Right. So we've established here that the Lincoln County charge was not the basis for the appeals referee's decision, and the appeals referee did not consider indigency and did not consider the supplemental information that Mr. Henry brought in discussing the dismissal of charges and therefore his claim that there was not misconduct. Am I missing something there?
I think I sort of lost you where you were going with it. I was asking a question. I lost the back end, the end of your question, I guess.
Okay. Well, the point is that was there a full hearing in front of the referee where the referee considered all the law and the facts that existed in the case?
Well, certainly there was the hearing and certainly the referee informed Mr. Henry this was the, was one option to present evidence and all that. So I guess that it was. I would point out
was the record supplemented though?
The record was not supplemented from what?
Not in the district court, but in front of the appeals referee by bringing in the records from the justice court and the municipal court.
No, not that I'm going to.
Well, how do those get in the record then?
I'm not sure. I'll be very honest. I mean, but certainly anything that was, I know Mr. Jordan well enough to know that he wouldn't be supplementing the record with something that was not part of the record from from the court. It wasn't something he just made up and added as the case went along.
Well, it seems to me that the appeals referee actually took a look at it, because remember you said the hearing was continued, and she looked, it appears, at the court documents and just said, no, you were incarcerated, that's sufficient disqualifying misconduct. And I need something more than this. I think, and I'm paraphrasing, but I think that's what she put on the record. And it appears that she actually did not do the analysis under Murphy regarding the two exceptions that Chief Judge Gibbons mentioned and that we've been discussing. That's problematic, isn't it?
I'm running out of time, but I think that is problematic. But the other issue, and again, is that the notification issue, which was also part of this, the record indicates there was exactly one call. The testimony is he had his mother call, not plural, make calls. So
actually, the Dieter records, I believe, say his family made calls. I agree with you, though, there is contradictory evidence in the record. But don't you think the notification issue should have at least been addressed?
I think it's always wise for the referees to address all issues when they're making their analysis. I would agree with the court completely with that respect.
So I know you're almost out of time, but maybe we could just give them a couple minutes to answer this question. Let's go back to the incarceration issue and kind of elevate that one level. So what's the standard you're proposing here? We asked, your counterpart for his standard, and he gave a pretty simple one, new criminal charges, new charges filed. So your standard here, the one you articulated at the beginning, was if it's due to his conduct, and in this case, not complying with the payment plan imposed by the court, then it's misconduct. So let me ask you this then, if you've done criminal cases especially, sometimes in criminal cases, people float in and out of custody through no fault of their own, right? Someone's arrested, they have the 48-hour hearing, they get a bail amount. It's usually just the standard paper bail amount. Then they file a motion to lower the bail. Maybe the DA files a motion to reduce the bail 15 days later in front of justice court. Maybe the bail goes up and down. Now he's either in or out of custody, right? Preliminary hearing is held, it goes up to district court. Now they file a motion in district court to either reduce the bail or increase the bail. He may be floating in and out of custody. Are you proposing that when you have things like that where the bail amount changes, because, you've seen it in criminal cases, they can change 3-4 times in the course of the case based on new information as things are discovered, right? So is the inquiry that you're proposing that in a criminal case with incarceration, we're going to dive into this and figure out whose fault all these floating in and out of custody really is? Was it the judge's fault? Was it the DA's fault? Was it his fault? Is that what you want us to do?
Well, I think the rule clearly is under Murphy that if a person's convicted anywhere along of anything, then that's
right. But if they're acquitted, which is what we have here, if they're acquitted, but nonetheless, in an acquitted case, are we going to dive into all this history of in and out of custody to decide what's his fault and what's not his fault?
Well, if the person isn't, I think the Evans rule is pretty clear that if a person is incarcerated for no fault of their own because they can't make bail, whether the bail's going up, down, or whatever, that, I don't think Evans makes that distinction. between, you know, what the bail amounts is. If a, I mean, years ago, a justice of the peace that I know of in Northern Nevada, you always sometimes set bail $1. His rule was, I want to see if you have any friends that'll actually post bail for you. And so I don't think the bail amount's relevant to that. I think the issue is what ultimately happens in the case. But unless the person is basically exonerated, then I think that's the Murphy exception. The Evans exception, excuse me, and Evans is an exception to the Murphy rule that unless the person is completely exonerated, then you have Evans, otherwise you have Murphy.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Neidert. All right, Mr. Ballard, you have less than 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to address briefly, once again, on rebuttal, the appeals referee decision, as was referenced while the counsel for respondent was just speaking. As Judge Bullen noted, but for this traffic warrant in Clark County, my client, Mr. Henry, would not have been arrested. He would not have missed work. We would not be here today. And I think what's important to note, that charge was ultimately dismissed by the Justice Court. And the failure of the appeals referee to take, one, the dismissal of the charge into account, two, the potential for indigency as the record supported, and three, the issue of dutiful notification that was also relevant here, all of those constitute errors on the part of the appeals referee. Now, for any of those reasons, that this case should be reversed and remanded on that grounds. But here we have all three. As all of you have noted, the transcript from the appeals hearing was sparse. You can see there were multiple times during that transcript, during that hearing, that it was suggested to be continued. So sure, it's continued so Mr. Henry can get the additional documents to support him. He gets those, and then they're not even put into the record, put into evidence. So clearly, there's a major issue with how the appeals referee conducted this review of the records, review and application of Murphy. Because again, as I stated previously, Murphy is very disanalogous in the facts and the holding to this case here. And again, for those reasons, we ask that this court reverse and remand the district court's denial of the petition for judicial review.
Mr. Ballard, I just want to clarify one thing, because I don't want to have a misstatement on the record. Are you saying that the documents showing that the Justice Court case was dismissed were not put into the record? Are you saying the appeals referee never reviewed them? And I ask you the same question that was previously asked. How did we get them in the record?
Yes, Ron. So I think what is clear is that in looking at the actual language of the referee's decision itself, that is not incorporated. So it's hard to know how that was taken into account if it's not even addressed in the language of the decision itself. Now, while we may agree to some extent whether or not it was reviewed or not, that's a different question from whether it was reflected and sort of considered and deliberated upon in the referee's decision.
Do you know how the documents made it into the record before us?
I believe they were attached in the district court for the petition for judicial review, if they were not included with the referee's decision.
So the record was supplemented then before the district court?
I believe it may have been, yes.
But we don't know for sure.
We don't know for sure, no.
Okay.
I wish I could answer with more clarity, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. This case will stand submitted for a written decision in the near future. We want to thank the appellant through Ms. Hanks taking his case in the pro bono program and also enlisting the aid of the Boyd School of Law. Obviously, I'm sure you saw what Mr. Ballard did. He did a very fine job, and he has a good career in front of him, probably as a trial and appellate lawyer. So, Mr. Neidert, thank you again. We've had several cases with the Employment Security Division. Sometimes these get put into the pro bono program. That's typically been the Supreme Court doing it, not us. And then they transfer the case to us. But it really helps to get the background from the people that work in the system and deal with this all the time so we can understand it a lot better than we might otherwise understand some of these administrative cases. So we really, really appreciate the effort that you put into it and for coming down to Las Vegas also. So we have anything else before we go into recess?
Well, thank you both so much for being patient and answering our questions and for the excellent argument on both sides. Thank you.
Yeah, and I want to read it. Thank you all for taking this case pro bono. If you have any colleagues from Boyd here, I would encourage you guys to think about doing this. I don't know if you guys talked about this at Boyd, but there are thousands more cases that need lawyers than there are lawyers willing to take them. And it's always great to see a lawyer and a law student willing to do that. It's good experience, but it's great for the litigant. Sometimes you have these cases like this where there are interesting issues that you can pick up from the argument, where there's, you know, potentially a gap between certain cases there. But without a lawyer, who's making that argument? And so, and there are so many cases out there like this where I just wish there were more lawyers. And so, we really appreciate both of you willing to step up and devote your time, because I know, especially getting into appellate cases, they're pretty time consuming. You have to read the record and do this, all this research, and it's a real sacrifice, but it does help the litigants and it helps us. We get better arguments. We kind of get a better view of what's going on there, versus a pro se case where we wouldn't have these developed arguments. And so we appreciate it. We hope you tell all your colleagues, all your fellow law students, what a great experience this was. If it was a great experience, assuming it was,
but if it was,
tell them, you know, tell them your experiences and encourage them to take some of these cases. Cause like I said, from our point of view, we see so many cases where we just wish someone would step up and take the case, but there just aren't enough lawyers willing to do it. So hopefully, you know, all of you future lawyers can help fill in that gap a little bit.
Thank you. All right, we'll be in recess.